I'm Kyra Kellawan, an international educator with experience of careers and college counselling in schools and universities across four countries. You're listening to the Piloted Podcast, a show about innovation in education for teachers, parents, and students. Hi, and welcome back to episode 8 of Piloted. This week I meet Peter Darby Crook, MBE, who is currently Director of Education at the DuPont Education Group in China. Peter's expansive career in international teaching and headship positions has seen him lead schools not just in the UK, but in Dubai, Singapore, Jakarta, Tokyo, and Oman. In October 2018, he received an MBE, Member of the Order of the British Empire, which is one of the UK's highest honours, for his services to British communities abroad through education. I really enjoyed talking to Peter. He has a caring, nurturing approach that comes from an understanding of being not traditionally academic, something he admits to himself. Being such a successful educator rarely starts out with a story of your own trials and tribulations at school and with exam taking. However, Peter was refreshingly honest about this. So I started out by asking him about the journey towards teaching, given his wrestling with formal exams at school. So tell me, how did you become an educator, Peter? And thank you for joining me, by the way, on the podcast.
You're welcome. Delighted to be with you. Well, by accident, really. I was left with a distinct impression from my education, which was fairly traditional working class education, that there were some children who were naturally bright and smart, and there were some children who weren't. Never the twain shall meet. You're either one or the other. I enjoyed the arts. I enjoyed sport. Very fortunate to go to a technical school, secondary school, which had good metalwork, woodwork, and engineering drawing facilities. And so I just thought that was what I was bound to do. I was never really going to be academic and look towards academic career in anything. So I wasn't that certain what I should do. I just met a student who'd left earlier who'd gone to St. Mary's, Twickenham, to train to be a teacher, a PE teacher. And I thought I could go and do maths, and I love PE. And it's a long way from Bolton, where I lived. So I thought, that's for me. So I went for an interview and was very fortunate enough to get in. Mm-hmm. So I kind of drifted into teaching and education. I didn't feel as though it was a vocation for me.
And you talked a little bit about the system in the UK for those listeners who aren't familiar with what the education system was like at the time that you were studying. You talked about the 11 plus. I wonder if you could explain, or maybe we'll come back to that later, but I wonder if you could explain a little bit about how that worked and why that meant you were at a technical school.
Yes. So it was decided, I think Cyril Burt, I stand to be corrected, produced some evidence to show that by the time you were 11, your academic potential was evident and wasn't going to change. So they might as well test you then. And then you could either go to a grammar school if you were clearly academic and you scored well in your 11 plus, or you could go to a modern school. I don't know why they called it modern.
A secondary modern, right?
Secondary modern school, where you were less academic and the program would be more suited to you.
And more suited, so, meaning?
Yeah, for the less academic, easier, I guess. Mm. Easier, yeah. Easier courses. In those days, the grammar schools tended to do what we call our GCSEs, and there was an easier version of those called CSEs, which the modern school used to offer, and you could do anything from one or two CSEs up to 8 or 9, I suppose. I was fortunate in that I went to a technical school, which was ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. And you could have, within that school, a combination of both. So you could follow a modern curriculum. But in some subjects, if you proved to be better than they thought, you could be in the technical side and in the grammar side. So that was quite interesting. I never actually managed to get into the grammar side. The 11 plus was an interesting exam. At 11 years of age, I had to go into the centre of the city with thousands of other children and find my room in the technical college and sit an exam at separate desks. This was the 11 plus. I can't remember the content of it. And then a chap, I guess he was a teacher, was walking around, and he noticed that I was on the wrong page doing the test, and he had told you when to turn over, and I must have turned over two pages at once. And I was on the wrong page. So he sent me home.
Gosh.
He took the booklet off me and sent me home and said, you'll need to come back and do it again.
Oh, my God. You know,
which I thought for an 11-year-old was a much, really. My parents
quite stressful.
Really. It was. It was. And anyway, having a second shot at it didn't do him much good because I still didn't get into the grammar school. Fortunately, the school that I went to was just right for me. I enjoyed all the things that it had to offer. I think if I'd gone to a grammar school, they were so academically focused and driven, it wouldn't have worked for me at all.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about it because my mum also failed her 11 plus and she sort of has been traumatized, I think, by that whole experience, by the exam itself, and then by the meaning that was attached to all of it at that time that sort of just seemed to determine the way her life was going to go.
Yeah, I can see that happening.
So how do you think that whole experience then and that educational trajectory has influenced how you feel about school and what it's meant to you as an educator as you move forward?
Well, as a teacher and as a trainee teacher, I began to think about how I could help children and how they were different. But I also noticed how they changed. So a child of 11 could be very different by the time they're 14 or 15, which I started to question this idea of having a fixed intelligence at the age of 11. And some people had different interests in different subjects and different areas. And I began to challenge the thought that the academic subjects were more valuable than the other subjects, the non-academic subjects, the arts and so on. And I began to think, well, actually, maybe the academic people would benefit from a bit of, we didn't call it EQ then, we called it common sense. It's the same thing. And I thought the people who come through the modern school could benefit from maybe having opportunities later in life to take academic subjects again and pick them up. Because we certainly had, I taught children who at the age of 11 showed no academic inclination, but by the time they were 17 and 18 were taking certainly grammar school subjects at that level. So I just felt there was something wrong with the system, and maybe it wasn't true that you were born academic or non-academic after all.
Right. And you've worked in schools all over the world, obviously. So tell us a bit about your first schools and then sort of as you gained experience, what kind of schools you actively chose to work in later on.
I was trained as a secondary PE and mathematics teacher. Before I was leaving, the local parish priest called me and said he had a job for me in a primary school back in Bolton. Well, I had no intention at that time of ever going back to Bolton apart from to see my parents. He didn't let me refuse. So I ended up going back to Bolton and teaching in a primary school, hating it at the beginning and then learning to love it and enjoy it very much. And in fact, I became a headmaster when I was 30 years old of a primary school in Bolton. I was there for 7 or 8 years. So it gave me a really good grounding into the beginnings of education and how we pigeonhole children or how we keep an open mind and what happens to them as they grow and develop through the primary years. So I started my career in primary school. So I went then to London, to Wandsworth, and taught for a couple of years. I was a head in London for 2 years in a primary school before going abroad. And I found out in a pub one night that people actually worked abroad. Teachers worked abroad. I thought, wow, how do you do that? And I looked for a job and was fortunate to be appointed to a role in the Middle East. I did some work in the secondary school, so I was moving a little bit back towards the secondary. But the main thing it did was I met a whole group of people with different understandings of what education was and the purpose of it.
Yeah. So was that because it was an international group who'd, you know, done their teacher training in different places, or?
The teachers in Dubai were all like me. They were expats. But the students actually in that school were all highly privileged, the Sheikh's children. They were delightful children, but I would say they were abused by privilege.
Right.
they needed for nothing. They really didn't need education. because they would be guaranteed financial stability and opportunities, and probably wouldn't have to work either when they were older. So, you know, motivating and encouraging these children to participate was not easy. So, and I'd never come across that before for that reason. You know, there are lots of children in England didn't want to work either, but for different reasons. And then I seriously got into the business when I moved to Oman, a British school, Muscat, to open the senior school there. So then I'd moved back into whole school, primary and secondary responsibilities.
Okay, so then you really had your chance then to create a culture within a school. What did you set about doing in terms of creating the right learning environment?
I enjoyed being a school leader. I was beginning to work out what kind of leader I was. I'm not a dictator. I'm not an autocrat. I work with people and try to get the best out of them. I don't shout at people. I don't get angry.
Mm-hmm. That's really important.
Yeah, a couple of times people said, I think you should get angry and shout more often. But I noticed that the New Zealand Prime Minister, the same thing happened to her, and she defends vigorously her approach,
yep.
her patience yep. and calm approach, and I do too. So I was never one for shouting somebody out or losing my temper with people. I didn't think that really did any good. So I wanted to create a community which was positive, was inclusive, so that nobody got left behind, because I always felt for the children who, for whatever reason, weren't thriving. And there wasn't a lot of talk about it at the time, but I just wondered how we could reach those children with our curriculum. And I felt there, and for a few years after that, very restricted. And this feeling grew that our secondary schools just didn't encourage that, didn't encourage our young primary students coming through with energy and enthusiasm and love and care, excitement, mm-hmm. forgiveness, all of these things that young children have. It was very difficult in the secondary school to continue that kind of ethos. And how could I do that with the school? That was a challenge.
The trajectory that you've had then shows you that in primary school, we have all of these values that are embodied. And as you say, children sort of, on the whole, pretty much love learning unless there's something drastic going on with them at home. So yeah, where does that go? What do we do to these students in secondary school then that makes, in your opinion, that makes that change?
Well, to answer that question, you need to look at the end of secondary school. So when our secondary school students leave, most of the ones that we work with want to go to university or further education. And whatever they need, whatever they demand, it's A-levels, IB wasn't then, IGCSEs, GCSEs, secondary school has to get on with preparing you for those. And so probably by the age of 13 or 14, schools started, and some still do, to strangle completely the lovely learning process and growing process that children have had in the primary school in favor of training. And the academic takes priority on the timetable in terms of importance, in terms of kudos, and the other things are secondary to that and not as important. And getting the best results possible out of you is the drive. So you actually lose sight of the individual and what's good for that individual.
Because the focus has become about the exam rather than the individual.
Yes, exam and school results and getting to university. And really that we all got lost in that process as individuals.
Well, you went first to Singapore, I know, and now you're in China. What were the differences there? What did you notice then about that transition from primary to secondary in those contexts? I have an opinion, but I'm not sure if it's correct. So I'd love to hear it from you.
Well, I actually went to Tokyo and then Jakarta.
Right.
And then Singapore. The difference in Asia is that there is still, and this is not necessarily expats, expat children, they're quite motivated. They've got a lot of support from their parents, so they are a bit different. But the ethos is a work ethos. The harder you work, the better. The more time you put in, the better. And also that kind of more, the more pain it causes, it's like medicine in the olden days, the nastier it was, the better for you it was. So the harder things were and the more miserable you were through work, that had to mean that it was better for you. And since I've come to China, and I actually talked a lot in Singapore to students, and I would ask them questions like, so what's your purpose in life? And you know, in Singapore, the children said, the Singaporeans said, to serve my country. How incredible is that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they were very focused on what they could do for their country. And they knew that the best way to do that was to get the best, to go to the best schools and get the highest results, whatever it cost.
Gosh. And what did that actually mean? What did that translate into as far as their interactions with the outside world, I suppose?
I'll give you an idea of how distorted it made family life. So I had a request from a parent who worked in our school, whose child went to a local school for 3 months' leave to help her son prepare for his exams. He was 10 years old. And she wanted to take 3 months off to help him through his very, very important exams. I mean, my goodness, I mean, how those children feel, you know? But what's important in life, you know, the distortion of the benefits of the academic that was going on, and everybody accepted it.
Yeah, I think that's what allows a system to perpetuate, obviously. So when you thought about what kind of culture then you wanted with this non-authoritarian, kind, sort of open line of communication style of managing a school, I assume then that you wanted change as well for the type of students in your charge. What were your overarching goals then for the school? What kind of people did you want to produce? Because I think that's the difference that sometimes, as educators, we get caught up in the results and in the figures. But what kind of people did you want to produce?
I wanted to nurture with the staff and with the community children who realized how lucky they were, who didn't judge themselves based on very narrow criteria, who could enjoy today as a day in itself, not as just preparation for something else, who had confidence in themselves and able to communicate and express themselves and felt free to say, my favorite subject is drama. my favorite subject is music. And I love playing the violin or whatever, you know. So, and children, you know, who are totally focused on the academic aren't able to say that hand on heart. So that's what I wanted, and ultimately for them to flourish. This is the word I use a lot, really, which means to not only be to have some success in life, but also to be happy and able to live happily with others.
So how do parents feel about that vision?
Well, you know, when I've spoken to lots of parents individually and in large groups. And when I describe it the way I'm talking about it now, they all agree.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to their children approaching their exams, they can't resist slipping in to the, well, of course, you know, she does need a star to get to the university that we wanted to get to. So In reality, they find it very difficult. Or if the child is opting for or passionate about something which they don't believe is good for them, isn't academic enough usually. Mm. So I remember a lovely girl who played the lead in all our school musicals, incredibly talented, and was offered a place at RADA. And the father wouldn't allow her to go.
Oh, And it's so difficult to get in the first place.
I know. I was talking about how, what a privilege it was and how amazing it was. And he was just convinced that his job was to make sure that she didn't waste a life. That's how he saw it, wasting a life somewhere like Radha.
It's amazing, isn't it? I feel like there's such a disconnect between what we say is important, what we tell ourselves, what we tell our children is important when they're little, and then what we tell them as adults. And the last person I had on the podcast runs an organization in South Africa working with students who just, you know, his goal is to see them, he said, not to produce successful 18-year-olds necessarily, because they will come to him with a metric of being able to succeed in some way. They've sort of gone through this selection process to be there, but to produce happy 30-year-olds, to produce people who actually enjoy life and have found whatever it is that makes them come alive, was the way that he put it. I don't think there's any parent out there who would say they don't want that for their child, but then there's this looming specter of having, you know, this future that can only happen if things go a certain way. And I've come up against that so much as a college counselor, as somebody working within that field. I'm trying to sort of unpick then, what do you think happens there? Why is there a disconnect between what we say we want and what we do?
It's purely a question of priority. What's the priority for the school and for the parents? I've done this with teachers. I say to a group of staff, so what do you think our job is? What are we trying to do here? And their kind of answers come out. We're trying to develop good people. We're trying to create a positive ethos in the school. We're trying to get students to work together. All these kind of ideas come out from the teachers because they're educationalists. Mm-hmm. So I say, okay, then, if that's the case, what do we have on the front page of the report to our parents? Maths. Second page, English. Third page, the sciences.
Yeah.
So what kind of message? The report that goes home sends a very strong message to the children and the parents of what we believe is the most important. The things at the front we believe are the most important. That shouldn't be the way it is. The front page should talk about the profile of the student. Mm-hmm. And the other qualities that you're talking about that we believe are so important. So the tool I used in Singapore to try and redress the academic balance, and it wasn't just my idea, I worked with a great team of people. We introduced the IB learner profile, which just took the emphasis away from the academic. The academic is important. And it's part of the picture of a developing and growing child, but it's not the most important thing. And through the IB learner profile, we were able to shift our focus and our priority, list of priorities, and begin to persuade the parents that there are other things important in your child and your child's life besides the academic scores.
So was that a completely IB school in Singapore? You did mid-primary years, middle years, diploma.
What happened was the students did the GCSEs, IGCSEs at 16. And then in sixth form, they could choose either A-level or IB. Right. It was interesting, actually, because in order for that school, which was a high-achieving academic school, to introduce the IB, the school had to fall over backwards to persuade everyone that the IB diploma had some rigor and was challenging, you know. And the problem was, I think we overdid it, because then everybody, only the top students, turned to the IB diploma. And actually, it would have been very, very suitable and helpful to a wide range of students. You don't have to score 40 points or plus in the IB to be successful.
No, not at all. And in fact, it's really, really valued by everybody who takes it after, you know. I mean, I think about it from university's perspectives, but yeah, it's a very, very in-demand qualification. The learner profile. Would you mind, for those people who aren't familiar, just running through a few of the elements of the IB learner profile and what it holds up as important in its learners?
Yeah, it has things like being a risk taker. Because, I mean, this was the problem with children who were all academic. They never really faced any risks because they could do it. It came easy to them. So risk taker is one, being resilience, having resilience, sorry. And that's so important in life, to be able to take knocks and come back, to be able to collaborate, to work with other people. So the kind of things that embellish our lives and become very, very important. And the challenge for us was how to make them a priority in our curriculum, one, and two, how to identify the profile of each student in these areas, which are not easy to measure. And to you can't just do a test, an easy test, you know.
No, so, you need to know your kids. And you know, that report on the first page, if it doesn't start with maths and English, who writes the first page is the question.
Yeah. Well, the answer to that is that's a really good question. The answer to that is the student. Because, the student needs to understand him or herself and understand what his or her profile is and be conscious of that. And if they are moved then to do something about it, they can. It shouldn't be the teacher. The teacher is part of the discussion, the ongoing discussion. But actually, that front page should be written by the students. And if there's something in there that they don't like, risk taker, they say, actually, I'm not very good at taking risks. I'm not very good at taking decisions. I mean, that is very important for a student to appreciate and to realize.
Yes.
And then you can help them develop strategies to be able to deal with that.
I love that. So, you know, teachers would always complain at my last school about the number of reports they had to write and the frequency of them. And then, of course, you know, the main question about feedback now is who's it for and who's reading it and does it affect the student at all? So I love that you had your students involved in that case.
Yeah, and this is the beginning of the revolution of education.
All right, that sounds good. Let's get to that.
Yeah, I think when we look back, we'll say that it more happened to change and improve education in these 20 or 30 years than ever before. I hope so, because it's been static for so long. It hasn't changed for so long. And this was the beginning. I'm talking about 8 or 9 years ago now. This was the beginning of elevating the student to be the most important person in their learning, involving them in their learning, in the process. Moving away from the teacher being the font of all knowledge, who empties knowledge into the children, and the old-fashioned kind of thing, which still happens a lot. So the flipped classroom, blended learning, topic work rather than subject work, so that it's interesting and stimulating to the children. So that is far easier to do in the primary school than it is in the secondary school, where the curriculum is dictated by the examinations. So the junior school, we had wonderful teachers and leaders in Singapore. The teacher would start a project with a wow day. Mm-hmm. Call it a wow day. So with the students' ideas, and they would talk about what they want to do and the project they want to do and what it might look like, and they would design the structure of it, and they would just have a fantastic day, and they would go home so excited about this project that they're going to do, because they'd be part of the designing and planning and purpose of it, and what they would get out of it as well. That is far more difficult to do when you're studying GCSE biology, for instance. I mean, I don't want to knock our secondary teachers. They were great people, and they did a great job of delivering something which is acutely focused on an exam at the end. They made it as interesting as they could, but really their hands were so tight as the children got older and older that they got more and more difficult to keep the child right in the center of their learning, involving them in their direction and their journey of learning and growth.
Right. So talking of learning and growth, you've talked already widely about the concept of a learning and growing center or a new learning and growing model. And I wonder if you could unpick what that would mean a little bit for the listeners.
Well, it occurs to me that so many things are becoming bespoke now. So, you know, if you get a flight, book a flight, you can have a seat with more leg room, or you can have a comfier seat. You can choose your food and this kind of thing. You can choose to be let on the plane earlier than the others. If you go to a hotel, there's often lots of options that you can have. And so people are providing bespoke services. And I just wonder why we don't provide a bespoke service for education. Because this is somewhere where it would be incredibly invaluable to be able to do that, to break free of all the chains, and there are many of them, that prevent us putting the child first. And it's easy to say the child comes first, but actually the child doesn't come first. There are many, many things. The school year comes first. The school day comes first. The subjects, whoever thought of delivering learning and growing in subjects when life doesn't happen in subjects? You know, it's a distortion of real life. And I think we ought to begin to break down those chains and do it differently.
So the chains, I think that, you know, some of them have been coming down, or at least have been lowered during COVID, right? We've seen that the school day can't exist in the way that it used to, and that the place is not open for business in the same way that it was. And I've been talking to a lot of other educators about what benefits this could have and where this means we could take things forward to next, because we've seen that school can still continue and learning can still continue in many more ways than perhaps we thought was possible. But what are the biggest changes that you see us being able to sort of pull at and pull down most quickly?
There are some small wins. I'll tell you about the big wins in a minute, but there are some small wins. You know, we had a school close to us, another big, well-established school, and we very rarely spoke to each other. And yet we talk to the children all the time about collaboration. Why don't schools work more closely together to share their resources and to share what they have to offer between other schools? For instance, you know, if we want to do Russian, if a child wants to study Russian at my school and I don't have a Russian course, maybe the school down the road has. There are some easy wins, resources like, and this does happen, tennis courts and facilities like that, or a big theatre where they can perform. And I think if you start to break down the walls of the school, connect with the community, which is something we did quite a lot of in Singapore. There are a lot of scientists brought into Singapore, and we went to work in the laboratories with the scientists, not for lessons, just for the children to be alongside the scientists while they're doing what they do on an everyday basis. And we got great feedback. The scientists said it was one of the most valuable things they'd done, was to have children observing them and talking with them while they were doing their work. So to begin, the easy wins are to break down the walls of the school and to connect more with communities around them and what's available around them.
Mm-hmm. And that requires a lot of trust, doesn't it? Especially with fee-paying schools, I think that can be a tendency that there's competition between the sort of two best schools, or what's perceived to be the best schools in an area. And it does require an awful lot of trust. I think that's also a leadership question.
Yeah, because it's not usual. If it was normal, there wouldn't be an issue. But it's unusual for collaboration. In all the areas I'm going to talk about, there are some schools somewhere trialing and doing parts of it, which is fantastic. People are looking outside the box, beyond the tradition of the school day, of the school year, of the school operation. And that's great. But what I want to do is to keep the ball moving, keep people thinking about a vision for the future where the school is a completely different place, completely different experiences, not just some of the lessons delivered online because you don't have to employ as many teachers, you know, or it's more efficient or whatever, or entertaining. So I think that there is a very exciting mirage out there for me, and I'd like to make it a reality.
So this is the learning and growing concept we mentioned before.
Yes. Yeah.
So what does that look like? Who's it for? Where would you build your first one?
Okay. Well, I have to stop using two words to begin with. First one is education, because that means something different to everybody. And the one to each person, they feel very passionate about what it is. And if it's not what they think it is, then the walls come up, the fences come up straight away, and they're not interested. So I wouldn't talk about education. I wouldn't talk about schools, because people have images and memories of schools which are not the reality that I want to create. So I'd like schools to be called learning and growing centres, something like that, where they coordinate a child's learning and growth. But then for every individual, there is an opportunity to design their learning and growing journey. So a week at school at the Learning and Growing Centre, for instance, might mean, because you can't get away from the fact that you have to have relationships, you have to learn to work with and be with other people. So I don't think we'll ever get rid of that, no matter how much online stuff we do.
No, and I don't think anyone would want to now after having been alone in their house.
No, that's right. Yeah. I think you're right. So that is incredibly important, and then that will be the biggest part of the portion of learning and growing a child does. But also there will be opportunities to work with polytechnics, with companies, more seriously than we do now. Now we just spend 3 days there on a bit of work experience and that kind of thing. But if someone has a passion for something, if a child has a passion for something, we should work to find real opportunities and experiences for that child to spend some significant time in that environment. So that will be a part. A part of the menu would be connecting with online courses from all over the world. And that could be facilitated in school, but not necessarily. And then the school itself would be the subjects or the projects that the child is following would be completely different from a timetabled academic program they follow now. Of course, every child would need a tutor, someone who knows them deeply and cares deeply about them and helps them to design their journey and checks in every now and again to make sure that it's moving in the right direction. It doesn't have to stick to however many days, 180 days a year. It doesn't have to stick to 9 to 4, the school day, and it doesn't all have to happen in the old school building. So it's a bespoke opportunity which the child and the parents would be involved in designing and monitoring as it develops.
What's clear about Peter is that he appreciates each student deeply, and he comes across as an inclusive educator who places equal value on all of the subjects his students are learning. Perhaps that also emerged from being a primary school teacher to begin with, where subjects are often more blended and intertwined into projects. But it's also from this holistic viewpoint that Peter views each of the children in his care. When he speaks about learning and growing, his goals are to create and develop children who could show gratitude, non-judgment, presence, confidence, etc., and feel free to stay true to non-academic passions and interests that they have. Similarly to Corey Johnson of Imagine Scholar in Episode 6, Peter is concerned most with developing healthy, happy individuals who flourish and continue to flourish beyond their success measured at school or at university. And both educators have mentioned Simon Sinek's Find Your Why, which is another overlap for recommended reading that some listeners might also be familiar with. I appreciate that Peter is not content with producing really nice children who are largely unmotivated to help others, but that his vision for a lifelong learning and growing centre would celebrate stories of success of non-traditional achievers and those who made a difference in the world despite having a non-linear trajectory. Peter himself is one of a rare breed of senior leaders in education who can freely admit that he failed at something at school, and yet here he is, helping others to appreciate the breadth and diversity of skills and achievements that we don't often get to hear about. The gauntlet he's thrown down for any of us working in education at any level is an important one, to start with why. This simple question has been instrumental for change since time immemorial.
So where would I do it? Okay, well, there are schools who are close to this. The green schools that are opening are quite close to it. There are one or two schools around the globe that are trying to do something a bit different. But it would need to be an entrepreneur who believes fervently that learning and growing can be something completely different from what it is now. It can be interesting, exciting, motivating, and something that the child feels that there is for them and they're driving it along with their parents. And so your entrepreneur then would work with people like me and teachers, like-minded teachers, to create the first one. And when they do so, it will be like the first opening of B&Q. You know, people will say, why on earth an IKEA? Why on earth didn't we do this before? And when they see the first one open, they'll say, oh my goodness, these learning and growing centers are amazing. Why were we stuck in the mud for those centuries in an old school system?
Yeah, I have to say, I've been to a school which is a very, very similar model to the one you've just described here in Barcelona. And it was set up by an entrepreneur. And it does have a variety of people in roles as learning guides. So not necessarily teachers who trained as teachers. The key there is that the parents have agreed when their child is at that learning center that the child is going to be in charge of what qualifications they leave with. And I think that's a huge leap for, you know, the model that we've held, the masses, as it were, the idea of, and I think we're seeing this right now, of childcare being school and school being childcare and the two being interchangeable. But also, you know, just how to scale and how to make sure that we get this kind of personalized attention for every student. I think that's the challenge.
That's wonderful.
But it's
absolutely wonderful.
It's happening.
It really is. Yeah, it is. And I love that because, you know, this is how life should be. At present, as soon as a child steps into school, they step into something which doesn't reflect everyday life. You know, things like service, you know, I love that the IB has service as part of its program and requirement. But, you know, we ought to nurture children who passionately want to serve others and to help others. That should be one of our main jobs, and that would make a huge difference. Because we've got nice children, really nice people, really nice children who are still really not moved to sacrifice in any way to help others.
Yeah.
to serve. You know, like the Singaporean students who said, to serve my country. I love that in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, that they had something important to them which was outside themselves. And I think if you had a different environment, such as you're describing in Barcelona, that could be a big feature of that group of people. And as all of those children leave, they go out making a big difference to people's lives.
That would be wonderful, wouldn't it? And one of the things I'm always looking at is, how do we get parents to understand, and how do we get universities to understand? Because I think that's the challenge in a lot of the schools that you and I have worked in, to sort of reset what success is, or just reframe what success looks like. Because right now we are working within the confines of what parents think is necessary to get their child to X place after school. And I wonder what your thoughts are, you know, if you have any sort of challenges that you would set for your parent bodies or for heads of admissions, even at universities, you know, these desirable universities that we know international parents like. How can we encourage them to appreciate the lifelong learning and growing that we're talking about here?
Well, it isn't through persuasion. It really isn't, because they'll agree that they want those lovely things for their children. But when push comes to shove, they fall back on results and universities. So the way to do it there are many, many, many examples of people who have been highly successful in their careers who haven't gone through the university pathway. or have changed, started university and swapped, done something different. And we need to celebrate and share those people, demonstrate to parents that this isn't the end of the world. Not going to university, for instance, isn't the end of the world. Going to a different kind of institution, doing an apprenticeship, delaying. I mean, I like the fact that now it's kind of accepted that a gap year is a good thing. So, you know, we kind of rush, we dash into the next. This is the problem with school and the way it's set up. We're forced into the next bit of the race, the race to get a good job, the race to get to do this and to do that. And I think if we can demonstrate that many people do that and do it very successfully, and we would have to go to a lot of trouble to find them, to get them to share their experiences, genuine experiences with our parents, that would begin to help, I think, to convince parents. That's all that would work.
You know, there are some university-style programs or apprenticeship-style programs. So I'm minded of the Dyson School of Engineering and you know, that sort of semi-working, semi-learning, but obviously, you know, attached to a very important global brand that parents can recognize. And I'm thinking about opportunities for things like that, built with educators in the frame, of course, but links to companies and organizations who also value the fact that, you know, students have come out of school ready for certain things, but not ready for other things. So they're malleable, but they're bright and motivated. And I think, you know, for example, in the world of animation, it's been said anecdotally to me that it's not necessary at all to have a degree. In fact, you're out of date by the time your degree is over if you do an animation degree. The software's moved on. So what's important is that the student has a willingness to learn and a sort of desire, a hunger to keep on top of things.
The problem is that we leave it till they've finished school, finish university before they get that opportunity. Yes. If they were 13, 12 or 13, when they started that experience, they would grow up with it and they would learn what's necessary, what's needed, what attitudes are needed. But by the time they left the school, the assimilation into what we call the workplace would be much easier, more successful.
So what do you think is the role for teachers, Peter, in this new environment? If we change everything and teachers don't have their subject, their classroom, what are they going to think about all of this?
You know, the first thing I'm going to do is to stop using the word teacher.
Yeah, okay.
Again, you know, as soon as you say I'm a teacher, it gives lots of connotations of things which are unhelpful, I think are unhelpful anyway. I think it's the most exciting thing that could happen with existing teachers is to develop a new role. I know that the shift in pedagogy in schools is incredible for our present teachers. It just gives them a different relationship with the students, and they can learn alongside their students, and teachers and students learn something new every day, all your life. You never stop. It would be a great thing for teachers. They would be far more involved in nurturing each individual child than they are at the moment. And they would be able to see it through. There's no reason why it couldn't continue beyond the age of 18. That's another wall that could be broken down. So I think it would be great news for teachers. Sometimes people get anxious about change for all kinds of valid reasons. So you would need to take care that people don't get lost in the system and do end up being not motivated and not feeling valued. So you need to work at it. It's not easy, but it's absolutely possible. And I think the benefits far outweigh the downsides.
So in your current role, how much are you able to communicate this? Because I know you're in China where parental expectation is high. And what's your sort of contribution there to one step towards readdressing or reframing the conversation? Is it possible? Do you feel that there's opportunity for you to do that where you are now?
China is aware that its previous education system, just like all other education systems, is quite narrow. It produces great results because children work extremely hard and long and they're very dedicated and they're very bright. So that they do produce very good results in terms of exam results. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the citizens and the society, that they prefer preparing for in the future. And maybe governments tend to see that in terms of the economy rather than happiness. But China realizes, as is Singapore, Singapore's making huge changes and developments in its curriculum now. China is ambitious to do the same, and so are parents. They're very well aware of the need for their children to have global perspectives and to be able to think critically. But it's small steps. The existing situation is very established. Parents are very established and worried if they step outside of that. Although they agree with the motives and the ends, it might not work for their child. You know, and many families here have got one child, very precious to them, important to them. So it's small steps. We're opening schools here which have a bilingual section, and the attitude to learning and growing is intentionally different. And one of our biggest challenges is not the children. The children will accept it and understand it and do brilliantly in it. It's to educate, I might be using the wrong word there, but to inform our parents and get them on our side and behind it is the challenge. And we just do that bit. We demonstrate it in the schools with their children.
A respected educator with, you know, a long history of working in different schools and different contexts. I think it's really important to add your voice. And I know you've been doing that for years. What do you think, if there was a challenge you'd like to lay down then to anyone working with students at the next stage, because the next series of this podcast will be talking to university admissions directors and people who are responsible for making those decisions about who they take, which is, again, of course, you know, feeding some kind of insecurity, I think, in parents' minds. What kind of challenge would you throw down? What's the gauntlet you throw down to invite them to create real change?
Great question. So I agree with Simon Sinek. You've got to start with the question, why? Why are you doing what you're doing and the way you're doing it? And if you ask universities to answer that question, I think they will be slightly embarrassed to give their answers. And I think there's a desire in the universities now to themselves to move away from the way they've worked in the past. But they're caught up a little bit in the whole marketing and finance and revenue demands. So it isn't going to be easy for them. But maybe this crisis and the shift that we've all had to make to different ways of learning might be the opportunity for, I mean, this year, for instance, we haven't done any GCSEs. Yippee, yeah. I would say.
Yeah, or IB diplomas.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And yet the world will not stop. It will continue. So I would ask the people in higher education and further education to ask themselves why, hand on heart, and is that what you want to be doing? And if not, what can you do to change it?
Peter's job is not going to be made easy in China. He understands that parents are fiercely protective of their own children's interests and attribute success usually only to a strict set of desirable outcomes that include the right grades, the right universities, and the right career paths. But having Peter at the head of one of the country's largest school groups is an intentional statement of a growing discord with the old 20th century model. And as he himself mentioned, students are adapting easier to understanding that their career trajectories may look very different to those of their parents. Our role as educators, surely, is to widen the net of acceptance, encouraging the development of alternatives and continuing to link students with the ever-changing realities of the modern workplace. It's encouraging that the learning and growing centre that Peter envisioned is already on its way. Learn Life, an alternative school here in Barcelona, describes itself as an international community of influencers, innovators, weavers and changemakers who collaborate to promote future-ready paradigms for learning. Enriched by global contributions, they say that they aim to openly shape a new paradigm suited to a rapidly changing world and its learning ecosystems. You'd better believe that I'm going to meet some of their learning guides and some of their students in a future episode soon to see what that all means in practice. In the meantime, thanks so much for tuning in. You can stay up to date on Pilot Ed by following us on Instagram and Facebook at The Pilot Ed Podcast, or you can say hi on Twitter, just at The Pilot Ed. Thanks for tuning in.